I'm calling the meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order on March 20th at 3:21 p.m. Members present are Representative Tilton, Representative Culver, Representative Josephson, and Representative Keto, and myself, Representative Hughes. Representative Olson and Ledoux have been previously excused, and let's reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please remember to turn your phones off. We have three bills on the agenda today, HB 123, Established Marijuana Control Board, HB 120, Transportation Network Services and Workers' Comp, HB 58, Eligibility for Alaska Energy Efficient Loans. So first up is HB 123. We've heard the bill on two prior occasions, and public testimony has been closed. And members should have the CS draft in their packets as well as three amendments. And today it's my intention to take up the CS and set the bill aside. We have two members absent as well as our committee alternate, and other members have expressed interest in being present for the discussion of the CS and amendments to this bill. With that, can I have a motion to adopt the CS?
I move CS HB 123 version /W.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. And to explain the changes in the CS, we have Conrad is going to do that for us. So come on up. State your name for the record and proceed, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. If you could give me just a moment, Madam Chair, to shuffle through a few pieces of paper. Find my eyes. We propose CS that you have for approval by the committee was drafted at the request of the chairman with some consideration given to some member suggestions, and I'd just like to outline those changes at this point. I want to start by saying I think most all of the members are aware, but if not, I'll hit on that high point real quickly. When a bill is introduced by the request of the governor, it goes through our legislative legal drafting pretty much as it was submitted. When legislative drafting first gets their fingers into the pie, shall we say, they do some style and some drafting changes to make sure that everything complies with the legislative drafting manual. So some of the changes you will see are just that. There are formatting changes that happen with any bill that goes through the process such as this. And I will point out when there are something, not only those type of changes, but obviously the substantive changes. The first change, members will note, is on page 2, line 8. This change adds language that you would find in 0406, the Alcohol Beverage Control Board statutes. It adds the words, as a regulatory and quasi-judicial agency. Since the new Marijuana Control Board would act in that capacity, it seemed appropriate that that language be added. Second change is on page 2, lines 11 through 20. This is a reformatting issue, as I stated earlier. The old 1738.080B and C were combined into a new paragraph B. The definition in the old C of 1738 was moved to the definition section later in the bill, which is section H. The next change is on page 2, lines 21 through 29, drafting style changes again, and some renumbering. Next change is on, before I lose my place here, page 3, lines 3 through 5, again, drafting style changes, some renumbering going on there as well. In on page 3, line 8 is the first change of any substance, and even that's not much of a substance. In the initial bill, it used the word title. In this CS, we changed that word to chapter because Title 17 contains much more than Chapter 38. There are other statutes, other sections of law that we aren't going to be subject subjecting everyone to. So we narrowed that just a touch. In paragraph H as well, this is where the marijuana industry definition was moved, as mentioned on a previous page. The next change is on page 3, lines 28 and 29. We're adding in the language within 30 days by appointment. This deals with the vacancies occurring on the membership of the board. Should a vacancy occur, the intention is to have the governor fill that position as quickly as possible. The next change you'll find on page 4, lines 6 through 9. This language was added from 0406, 050, requiring that the board meet at least once each year in each judicial district around the state. This is to consider any other need to modify existing regulations in light of the statewide or local issues in that particular jurisdiction. It just puts the would put the board out a little more in touch with areas around the state. The next change is on page 4, lines 11 through 13. There is a style change, drafting style, in that section. There's also one word deleted on page, on line 11, following the word approve, the word all was deleted. Again, really a drafting, a style change. The next change is on the same page, line 29 through 31, again, a drafting style change, conforming with the legislative drafting manual. The next change is on page 5, lines 3 through 14. There's a new, two new paragraphs being added. These deal with enforcement and the staff that the new board would consider necessary to enforce the statutes. The new paragraph, I've got an error in my notes. The new paragraph F would require notification by the board to municipalities and licensees of major changes in regulation and statute, just simply keeping the licensees up to date on any changes that might come about. The next change is on page 4, line 29 through 31.
Page 5.
I'm sorry, page 5. Another minor typo. My apologies. Line 21 through 24, this is new language from the Alcohol Beverage Control Statutes, 0406-110. It was the feeling that if we are dealing with currently, if the Alcohol Beverage Control Board should needs the authority to deal with potential prostitution and sex trafficking, we're still dealing with a drug, albeit in a completely different form. There is the potential for similar illegal acts to take place. So the feeling was to add that language in to make sure that the board does have whatever authority they may need. The next change is on page 6, line 5, and that is again a drafting style change. Page 6, line 22. Madam Chair, I assume that you're going to stop me if I'm buzzing through this just a little too fast. Everybody's fine?
Everyone okay? I think we're good. Go ahead, Conrad.
Next one is on page 6, line 22 through 23. This is the sunset provision. This provision would sunset the Marijuana Control Board on the same date that is proposed in another bill in the process, House Bill 116, that is the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, the proposed sunset for the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. For obvious reasons, we would want them to sunset at the same time. The next change that I've noted is on page 7, lines 1 through 15. This makes a change to the membership of the proposed board that would require the governor to appoint two members. The two members that would potentially be from the marijuana industry should be appointed from the persons who have alcohol industry experience, whether it's retail or wholesale, and those two terms for those two individuals would sunset, or would end, sunset's the wrong term, would end in 2 years. The idea being that the folks in the alcohol industry, currently regulated and will continue to be regulated by the ABC, have some knowledge of regulatory process, the regulatory oversight activities of the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. There is obviously a lot of parallel between the two boards. The other concern was, in the bill we define the marijuana industry, those two positions may be held by someone in the lawful, basically lawful practice in the marijuana industry. At this point, we don't have a lawful marijuana industry, and the concern was not having as much much of a pool of appointees to choose from. There does seem to be a little more discussion on this particular change in the bill, in this, the proposed CS, but there has been a lot of concern expressed that that pool may be rather small. The next change, Madam Chair, is on page, make sure I'm looking at the right place here, page 7, line 10 through 13. And again, these are drafting style changes to conform with the legislative drafting manual. And Madam Chair, I'll apologize up front if I've missed any changes that were made in the CS. I believe those are not only the substantive changes as requested of Ledge Legal, but also all of the style changes.
Okay, thank you, Conrad. And Conrad, if you would just stay there. We also have Kathleen Frederick with the Office of Administrative Hearings and Cynthia Franklin from the Alcohol Beverage Control Board online in case there are any questions. So do members have any questions about the CS? Representative Kito? Oh,
Conrad?
Sure.
One question I do have, thank you, Madam Chair, is on the meetings in the judicial districts. Can you let me know how many meetings the board is anticipated to have? Is that going to be a monthly or quarterly? And then will that adequately provide opportunities for everybody to be involved in the process as we have meetings? I think, are there six judicial districts? Are there four?
Four.
I guess as kind of a follow-up to that, I guess I'm wondering if we are going to have standing meetings in each one of those districts for each of the quarterly meetings, or if the board is anticipated to meet monthly. I don't see that in the CS.
Through the chair, Representative Kito, I think that question might be better answered by Cynthia Franklin, the director of Alcohol Beverage Control Board, as that is the current practice of the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. And I would, I think it's envisioned that it would be a similar time frame. The timing of the meetings in the various judicial districts in the alcohol beverage control statutes are not specified, and she could give you a better idea what their intentions would be.
Cynthia, are you online? Can you answer that question? Did you hear it?
I did, Madam Chair, and I can answer the question. Representative Kito, through the chair, the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board currently meets 5 times a year, one each in each of the districts, including a meeting in Anchorage, and then a fifth meeting per year in Anchorage due to the number of liquor licenses that we have in the South Central area. They are approximately quarterly. We meet in February or thereabouts in Juneau. We meet in April in the Anchorage area. We meet in July in Fairbanks, in October in Western Alaska, generally Nome, and then another meeting in December in Anchorage. And those meetings are set at the previous meeting. So the times vary. They're not set in stone because we've got 5 volunteer members of that board that are meeting. Those are adequate for the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board to address all of the issues that have arisen and to get out there in those communities and address the community's needs as well. What we would anticipate if the bill passes in the structure that it was introduced is that we would see the Marijuana Control Board meeting in conjunction with those ABC meetings. So in other words, we would have 2 days of meetings back to back, Day one would be the ABC, and day two would be the Marijuana Control Board. And the reason for that is because then we could save quite a bit of travel money on staff travel. We do have staff that travel with the board to those locations and accompany them on those meetings in order to facilitate the board meetings and record them and have them in accordance with all of the rules and public notice requirements. So for the last three meetings of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, we've had two-day meetings since we have had the marijuana, and we would anticipate just sliding that second day over to the Marijuana Control Board and saving money on staff travel in that manner.
Follow-up?
Yes, as a follow-up, but I think, are there contingencies or have you thought about the possibility that we might end up with a significantly larger number of marijuana license requests that may require additional meetings?
Representative Keto, through the chair, we don't know how many licenses we're talking about, but we have anticipated potentially the need in the first year or two for additional meetings. Certainly, when you're setting something up, it's possible that board would need to meet more often. We've let the statutory language loose so that the board can, there is a provision in Title IV for the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board to meet at the call of the chair. Some of that meeting language is in regulation, so we would anticipate with the language in the bill before you that we would either be able to promulgate a regulation or simply have the board call additional meetings at the call of the chair.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is for Ms. Franklin, but could you tell me the other person on the telephone? So I.
Catherine Frederick, Office of Administrative Hearings.
Okay, thank you. For Ms. Franklin, the work draft, do you have that in front of you? It's draft W?
I don't have it pulled up here, Representative Josephson. Let me pull it up here.
Actually, I think you'll know the context of the question. The proposal in the draft is to postpone the requirement that there be someone from the marijuana industry for a time. It could be, I guess, up to 2 or 3 years. And I'm just wondering what opinion you have of that, given that regulations would be formed in that period, and whether there's some loss of expertise as a consequence. I know that's a mouthful, but just as a sort of a point of reference, there's under powers and duties of the board, it says the board shall control cultivation, manufacture, possession, and sale. To the extent somewhere in the state we could find people who have studied these issues, is there some benefit to having them immediately on the board?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, we support having a voice on the board that was chosen specifically for marijuana knowledge, but we are also not opposed to having a voice from the alcohol industry from a regulatory perspective in the first 2 years. And we do see the point of someone in the alcohol industry or with alcohol industry experience and understanding this unique position of having a business in a highly regulated atmosphere. But I have met people since November who clearly have a lot of knowledge of marijuana, and the cultivation aspect of the plant is certainly different from alcohol.
And if I could, I'm going to ask, we would call this a leading question, but I'll ask it as a leading question. Isn't it fair that because of the Internet, for example, and conferences out of state, other forms of communication, that someone could be a law-abiding citizen, never have wrongfully cultivated or sold marijuana, but know a tremendous amount about both the botany and the industry?
Through the chair, I believe so. There is a lot of information out there. The other point, of course, is that personal cultivation has been legal in Alaska since 1975. So we do also have individuals in the state who know quite a bit about cultivating marijuana from the perspective of cultivating a personal grow, which is has been legal in someone's own home since the Raven opinion came out in 75.
Thank you.
Yes, and I have a question for you also, Cynthia. Just remind us of the number of years for the ABC board as far as the until sunset. Has that been every 3 years or every 5 years? And in this bill we have it, the Marijuana Control Board would sunset in 3 years. Is that the expected pattern, or is there anything in statute that is establishes it at 3 years on an ongoing basis? If you could just discuss that, please.
Madam Chair, the Alcohol Beverage Control Board is on a 3-year sunset provision. It's due to sunset June 30th, 2015, and HB 116 provides for an extension to June
30th,
2018.
Okay, so it is in statute that the Alcohol Board is a 3-year, or does that sometimes change every year? Just remind me. I know this committee deals with the those sunset dates a lot, but this is a new committee for me, so just remind me, is that something that's set in statute each time it is up for renewal?
Madam Chair, yes. It's a new date is set each time it's up for renewal, and it's been in a pattern of every 3 years.
Okay, so this is in line then with the Alcohol Beverage Board, Control Board. Okay, thank you. Are there other questions?
Madam Chair, if I could expand for just a moment.
Sure.
Thank you. As with all boards, the Alcohol Beverage Control Board is subject to sunset, as you said. And as with all boards, prior to that sunset, legislative audit goes through, does a review of everything from soup to nuts, is my understanding, and makes a recommendation to the legislature, and every year there's a bill, or at every sunset timeline, there's a new bill that would extend it. In some cases, I've seen boards extended as many as 8 years. Alcohol Beverage Control Board, obviously this time, is a proposed extension of 3 years. Just a couple of years ago, we saw the Regulatory Commission of Alaska down to as little as 2 years. But those are really a case-by-case basis. I think that saying that the Alcohol Beverage Control Board is on a continuing 3-year cycle would not be quite accurate.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Representative Colt, we have a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Conrad, turn on page 5 to line 15, enforcement powers. And I don't recall this section being in there before. It says the director and the persons employed for the administration and enforcement of this chapter may, with the concurrence of the commissioner of public safety, exercise powers of peace officers when the powers are specifically granted by the board. And then it goes on to they can also enforce sex trafficking and prostitution. My question is this typical in the alcohol beverage control regulations and statutes that we are granting the powers of peace officers to enforcement personnel of the Department of Administration, Board of Alcohol, Beverage Control Board?
Representative Culver, through the chair, just so I'm clear, I thought that you said page 5.
Page 5, line 15.
It is line 15, okay.
Yeah,
the enforcement
section
power.
17.38085,
yes.
Enforcement power.
Through the chair, Representative Culver, yes, it is. In fact, the enforcement powers, if you read Title 0406, and I would have to turn to my other note, the language that was added, the only language that was added in the CS is on line 21 through 24. Those are taken straight from alcohol beverage control statutes. Yes, sir.
Okay, follow
that
up.
That is the practice.
Is that at the request of the department? Or just didn't work on the bill in the office?
Representative Culver, through the chair, it is through the work on the bill in the office. Again, it was a comparison of the current bill versus Title IV ABC statutes. Again, drawing a pretty direct parallel between liquid drug, plant drug. They're regulating a drug of some sort. Unfortunately, human nature being what it is, there is a concern of, again, I'm just speaking to those four lines that were added with sex trafficking.
Right.
Gambling.
Representative Colburn?
Thank you. I assume there's some standards, attend the academy or something of that line. I wonder if there's a way to cite that, refer to that in statute. The only qualifications, if you will, of these people that are going to enforce the law are with this phrase in this string, the first sentence, with the concurrence of the Commissioner of Public Safety, and it goes on, may exercise the powers of peace officers. So that's a bit comforting, but not enough comforting, that I'm concerned. I don't expect this is a security guard that you empower with the ability to enforce the law for the state of Alaska, that I would feel more comfortable if we had a section in code we could refer to as far as what their qualifications are as a certified peace officer, or what that standard is for the trooper or the like. So maybe we can tweak that a little bit if we look at that.
Thank you, Representative Culver. Through the chair, I would suggest maybe we ask Cynthia Franklin to speak to that that language as it is directly from the alcohol beverage control statute.
Cynthia, can you address that, please, and how that works now?
Representative Culver and Madam Chair, the five enforcement officers currently employed by the ABC are licensed peace officers. The requirements for that come with their state job description as Investigators 3 and Investigators 4. So they are employed in a specific job category as state employees that requires that. They do receive that special commission from the Commissioner of Public Safety in connection with this job, since they're not granted general police officer powers as an officer employed with a local law enforcement agency or with the state troopers would be. So each of our five officers are licensed peace officers who are specially commissioned by the Commissioner of Public Safety to enforce. And as Conrad indicated, this language that you have before you is directly lifted from 406.110 in Title IV. That was written in 1980, and this provision has been in effect ever since and has been very effective. Our officers are extremely professional and tend to come as applicants from a pool of retired active duty police officers in the state.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Cynthia. And seeing no more questions, I'm going to maintain my objection, but we'll set this bill aside and the amendments until Monday, and we will take up the next bill on the agenda, which is HB 120. And to present the bill, it looks like we have Representative Dan Sadler with us. If you'd come on up to the table, please. Representative Sadler, you know the drill. State your name and
I do.
Proceed.
Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, this is Representative Dan Sadler, House District 13. It's a pleasure to be back in this room, although not at this end of the bullet barrel. I appreciate you hearing House Bill 120 today. Madam Chair, my community, Chugankik River, is a growing community. Bigger than you think. It's about 35,000 people. And we exist about 10 miles north of the core section of the municipality of Anchorage. Although we're a thriving, great community, we've had ongoing challenges in obtaining transportation services, both with our municipal bus system and the local taxi cab industry. This is, of course, if you don't have private-owned vehicles. Apparently, Chugiak River is too far from core Anchorage for consistent and timely taxi service. If you want to hail a cab from our community, you have to make the call or schedule ahead or wait up to a half an hour for someone to come out. And sometimes there's high costs for people that want to travel home to the river from Anchorage, and then the cabs might tack on an extra couple bucks for getting out to Anchorage. And our municipal bus system is continually threatened with reduced hours, reduced routes, and reduced service in general. So our hope is to see some relief from these transportation limitations by the new technology trends like Uber, like Lyft or Sidecar, which are known collectively as transportation network companies, TNCs. TNCs use smartphone applications and software to connect people who want to ride with available drivers willing to provide that service in a relatively short amount of time. I think there is about 10 seconds if a TNC driver has an opportunity to respond to a hail or not. If not, the next guy gets it. There's the hungry and the poor. Drivers who are connected through transportation network companies, are independent contractors. They obtain their own business license, they operate their own vehicles, they establish their own operating hours, and decide for themselves whether to accept or decline a request for a ride. Probably the biggest and best known of these, Uber, entered the Anchorage market in 2014 and created transportation options for my constituents, underserved communities like Chugetkia River to the north of Anchorage and Birchwood to the south of Anchorage, Girdwood to the south of Anchorage. Uber is currently in the process, in a larger sense, of negotiating with the municipality of Anchorage on how to might start operating within the full scope of its business practices inside the municipality and its legal framework. This bill tries to address a couple of minor issues that would help that process in my community and elsewhere in the state of Alaska. Madam Chair, HB 120, in essence, does two things. First, it defines what a transportation network company and a transportation network company service is. Companies that use digital networks and software to link passengers with drivers. It specifies that transportation network company services are provided from the moment that a driver accepts a request for services, for a ride, to the point where the passenger exits their vehicle. And the second thing HB 120 does is it offers to transportation network company drivers the same exemption from workers' compensation insurance coverage requirements as is enjoyed by other people in Alaska, including babysitters, some real estate professionals, certain sports referees and officials, and taxi cab drivers, because they're not employees, they're independent contractors. The Chugetkia River area has expressed a strong desire for more choice, more competition, and more opportunities for transportation services. You'll note in your packet there's a couple letters, a couple documents from the local Chamber of Commerce that I believe speaks pretty well for the people that supports this legislation. I think the HB 120 is one step towards addressing the changing market and transportation needs in underserved communities in Alaska. I thank you for your consideration hearing the bill and hope I can get your support of the legislation. I can answer some questions. We have some experts with the company available to answer other questions should you so desire. Thank you.
Okay. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sadler, if there was a way, if there were a way to make absolutely sure that we did everything we could to enhance TNC so that, folks, for example, in the Eagle River Chugiak area were benefited, but that there was no doubt and no shadow of a doubt, but that all participants in the enterprise were fully insured, would you be amenable to that?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, my intent here is to address some of the fundamental issues involved with transportation network company operations. I guess I'd say it would be my desire not to, to keep it a clean bill. I would not want to try to be everything to all people and to have, forgive me, the Uber bill. In the sense of, the Latin Uber, yes.
I know. Yep. Thanks.
Are there other questions? Okay, with that, thank you very much. And we will open public testimony then at this time. I do believe that there are some folks, so we'll open public testimony. And let's start in-house because I think some of those folks might help give us a foundation for a little more about this. This is new technology, is opening up whole new things. And so we will start off, with Mike Monagle with the Department of Labor, if you would come up here. You signed in first, apparently, so you are up first.
Lock on the door.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Monagle. I'm the director for the Division of Workers' Compensation. I am not an expert on network transportation network services, but I would like to speak to the department's position on the bill. The department is neutral. There are some areas of the legislation that I'd like to speak to. Before I do that, I need to put on the record that there is a companion bill in the other body, which I testified to the other day and made a comment that we were opposed to the bill, and that was not a correct statement of the department's position. Because the bills are identical in language, I don't want to cause any confusion. So the official position of the department is that we are neutral. That being out of the way, on page 2 at line 25, I think as the sponsor testified, the bill exempts a transportation network company or driver from the moment they pick up a passenger to the moment that passenger disembarks. What's unclear to the department is how that exemption would apply to someone who's at the curbside waiting for a passenger and something happens, or they're driving waiting for a passenger to contact them and they get into a motor vehicle accident. Is that person an employee? Are they still an independent contractor? So there's a little concern with the language in that section. Also concerned that the description, we do, as is noted, have an exemption in law for taxi drivers. However, the language here seems to be a little broader than just taxi-type services. It says that a person who operates a motor vehicle that is owned, leased, or authorized for use, and under the definition of having a technology platform, a smartphone to connect a driver to a passenger, it would seem that tour operators, if they treated their drivers as independent contractors with smartphones, could also take advantage of the same language in the bill. And while we acknowledge, the department acknowledges that there is an exemption for taxi drivers and taxi-type limousine services, expanding the bill further or the industry further into the tourism business would be of a concern to the department. And then finally, sections 3 and 4 of the bill provide a retroactive provision back to January 2014. And the department's concerned that an injured worker or a proceeding that is already in place would be nullified by the retroactive provision of the law. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd take any questions that the committee members may have.
Mike, I have a question, because when I'm reading on page 2, you talked about the person, the driver's waiting on the curb for someone, but here it says that it's at the point at which the person on line 20 accepts a request. So it's when, you know, the way the app works, the person clicks on it and they're making a payment, it's at that point. So the person sitting by the cab waiting, I mean, the person sitting by the Uber car sitting by the curb at that point waiting for someone, they've already accepted that request, so it would fit that. You seem to think that there was a gap there, so I'm confused.
Well, Madam Chair, at line 25, it says that a person is performing transportation network company services under this subparagraph when the person accepts a request for transportation. So if they're in between a request, if they're waiting for that next text or whatever the proper language is for getting that request, that is our concern.
Okay, I misunderstood you. I
thought basically, what happens to them in between calls?
Okay, I thought you were indicating they were waiting for a passenger to come that had made the request, so I just wanted to clarify that. Any other questions for Representative Josephson?
Thank you. Mr. Monagle, if you were to make the academic case that these are not independent contractors but employees, what case would you state? What would you say? And what policy decision is being made there?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, when we have instances that come to the department where there's an allegation that somebody's an employee or there's a dispute, probably is a better way to put it, between two parties, one asserts they're an employee and the employer says, no, they're an independent contractor. We use provision under regulation. It's called the relative nature of the work test. And there's a series of tests that you step through. One of the primary considerations is this a separate calling? In other words, is this work being done independent of the employer, or does the employer gain
significantly from the activities of the employee. But it's a series of steps, you know, who provides the tools and equipment, who sets the hours, does the employee have the right to hire others, are the conditions of employment set by the independent contractor or are they set by the employer? So those are the kinds of analysis that one would step through when trying to determine whether, in fact, someone truly is an employee or independent contractor.
And as a follow-up, if we treat this like the pebble in the pond, what are the ramifications of to the law and individuals of treating if we adopt the exemption, essentially?
Representative Josephson, through the chair. Ultimately, it's a you know, policy decision in the legislature whether to exempt a party or not. The department is always concerned about exemptions. There seems to be sort of a growing movement nationally to classify employees as independent contractors. We certainly struggle with this in Alaska. We have a staff of investigators, and probably one of the more common complaints we get, specifically in the construction industry, is when an employer classifies their carpenters as independent contractors instead of employees. There was a national delivery company, a Fortune 500 company, that classified their drivers as independent contractors, saying that they were leasing their vehicles and that the drivers were independent contractors. That matter was settled by the district court in California, and they were found to be employees, not independent contractors. So the department does have some concern about the growing push toward folks being classified as independent contractors, primarily because we want to make sure that the workers in Alaska have adequate coverage to make sure that if something happens to them, they have the means to have their medical costs and their wage replacement taken care of.
Okay, thank you. Cab drivers, did I hear you say that they are currently classified as independent contractors?
Madam Chair, yes. There's an exemption in the Workers' Comp Act for taxi drivers, yes.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Monocle. Next up is Sheldon Winters. State your name for the record and your affiliation. Proceed with your testimony, Mr. Winters.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sheldon Winters. I'm local retained counsel for State Farm Insurance Companies. Just some background, State Farm is the largest insurer of autos, personal autos in the country and in Alaska. So State Farm has no objection with TNCs, and we really have no position on the gist of this bill, which is to exempt TNCs from the workers' compensation requirements. We are, however, extremely concerned about the narrow definition of TNC services in this bill, a definition that may have dire consequences if applied elsewhere that this legislature probably never envisioned or intended. And I want to talk briefly about that today. Maybe the best way to bring this all to a head is to read to you just a couple of quick snippets from the Division of Insurance's consumer warning that's posted on their website about TNCs. And I won't read it all, again, just a few phrases. It begins with, Alaska Division of Insurance joins 14 other states in issuing a warning about the risks of rideshare and vehicle sharing programs. That number is now 22, by the way. 22 states have issued similar warnings. That describes ride sharing, and it explains that ride sharing programs, or TNCs, use an online service, as you know, with drivers who use their personal vehicles for prearranged taxi-like transportation services for hire. And then in bold, it states the division wants Alaskans to know that these programs may result in a denial of insurance for participating vehicle owners, drivers, and passengers. And the key couple sentences that I'll focus on here is from the Division of Insurance again. Personal auto insurance is not intended to cover individuals who use their vehicles for commercial purposes. Most personal auto policies will not, it's underlined, will not cover an accident that occurs when someone uses their personal vehicles for commercial purposes. It's what the Division of Insurance and the other regulators throughout the country are referring to as various gaps in insurance that are existing from this new industry that's emerging. And one of those gaps is the one that's the concern in this particular bill. Commercial activities of a TNC driver do not begin when the passenger is picked up, and they don't even begin when a passenger calls and there's this connection that there's going to be a ride. Commercial activities that are not intended to be covered by your personal auto insurance begin the moment that app is turned on. And typically the TNC driver turns that app on and then maybe driving around or sitting on the side of the street, but driving around roaming for customers. And that's a period of time that's not kept, not continuing this definition. It's similar to a taxi cab driver. This may not be the best analogy, but a taxi cab driver that turns his little light on and says, I'm for hire. Well, he hasn't got a customer yet, but he is engaged in a commercial activity at that point. And so are you and I and every other Uber driver or TNC driver that has turned that app on and is roaming around for passengers. With TNC drivers, it's actually probably arguably the most dangerous time because they are engaged in this app and, again, roaming for customers. There's been some tragic accidents during this critical period of time. There's been a very high publicity one, a death of a six-year-old, where a TNC driver, before they actually had someone for hire, but the app was on, ran into a family and killed a six-year-old girl. In that very high-profile accident, the TNC company took the position that because there was yet no, they fell without this definition, there was no passenger connection yet made, that the TNC was not responsible for that. So going back to this bill, our concern is that TNC services are defined too narrowly. And I'll just, Senator Hughes, you referred to the definition that purports to talk about when the connection is made. But I'll also point out on page 3, line 6, where it actually goes to the definition of transportation network company services, which is the key to this. It means transportation of a passenger between points chosen by the passenger, and then it says in prearranged. So it's arguably vague. Whether this definition means transportation TNC starts when the passenger is picked up, or even when the passenger, at an early point when the passenger is engaged, it does not include that roaming period that's critical. So this is a workers' compensation bill. Our concern is that this narrow definition will be used to preclude the injured party's recovery where it rightfully should be, which is with the TNC's, with the TNC. And our concern is basically twofold on that. First of all, that's what the TNCs have argued in the past, that because of the definition of TNC, anything before, even though the app's on, but before there's any passenger engaged, that's not a TNC activity. They've argued that. And if this bill passes, it will be the only law on the books in Alaska that defines TNCs currently. And I know from experience, I'm a defense lawyer, that the courts will look at this definition and there'll be an argument about whether workers' compensation applies or not, but they will use this definition and give some deference to it, and that's our concern. We propose some language with the sponsor, and we hope we can work with them, that broadens that to include what's everybody's calling basically app on. When the app is on, it's a commercial activity, it's a TNC enterprise, app on to app off. Very simple language. We hope we can work and get that in this bill. I'll just conclude with this, members of the committee. TNCs are evolving. They're here. My personal impression is they're a good thing. They're going to be evolving over time. You more than likely will be seeing other legislation coming with more issues about regulation, including insurance. And that may evolve over time. But the one thing we that cannot evolve, that we have to get right from the get-go, including in this bill, is the definition of TNCs. We do not want a definition of a TNC getting out there that ends up in the same situation as that six-year-old girl in California where there was no insurance coverage and there was no responsible party. And so we would ask you to consider broadening the definition, even in this workers' compensation bill. And I'll just add one last little point that kind of came to mind. I'm not a workers' compensation expert at all, but, and maybe someone who is can correct me on this, but when an industry is trying to put in statute an exemption from workers' compensation responsibility, you would think they would want that exemption to be as broad as possible. Now, why wouldn't they want to pick up this extra app-on period? I don't know the answer to it, but I do know it's very troubling with respect to the liability aspects. That's all I have. Thank you for your time. I'll take some questions. I will say there's another gentleman that's going to be speaking. He's from Property and Casualty Insurers of America. He's really the expert on this. He's been following it down in California in the South where it's kind of ratcheted up a notch. And so I can try to answer your questions, but he will probably be better.
Okay. This is public testimony. Typically, we don't take questions, but I'm going to let you stay up here because this is kind of a new area for us. And so, but we're going to have to keep it brief because we got to keep moving. So, Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Winters, it seems like your proposal is a win-win. That's how I see this for everybody, except that, I mean, obviously Uber is effective because it's cheaper and everyone knows it's cheaper. But there's some externalities that are not being absorbed by the transaction. That's what I hear you saying. Your industry wants to make money, but you're willing to cover people for injuries. The drivers of an Uber car would have more protection from the courts and potential litigation, and the passenger would be better protected, but the whole enterprise would cost more. That's sort of where I am on this right now. Is that a fair?
Representative Jobson, I think that's accurate, but let me add a little bit of, more to that. If our personal auto insurance was to cover this commercial policy, it's going to cost us. We're all in that insurance pool, and it's going to cost us all more money for that coverage. And the coverage should rest with the enterprise that is engaged in that activity, the commercial activity, the TNCs. So, yes, it's going to cost so much more money. Now, I don't want to speak for the TNCs, but there was some testimony yesterday, and I think there'll be some today, that part of the business model is to leverage the use of the personal auto policy to avoid having to pay for that. And that, you're right, that's the issue. But your personal auto policy does not cover that activity. We want to fill that gap. We want to make sure that's filled. And just to kind of wrap it up, at the end of the day, what you'll see in a more comprehensive liability insurance policy, insurance liability bill, that has passed in four other states is simply this, and it's in a nutshell, it's a statement that from the moment that app is on, it's made clear so that there's no mistake, the personal auto policy does not apply, and it requires the TNCs of the world to basically have commercial insurance that is primary from that moment on at whatever level the legislature thinks is appropriate.
Representative Culver, did you have your hand up at one point? No. Okay, Representative Keto.
Thank you, Mr. Winters. I've got a kind of a question. It's maybe a little bit more esoteric, but you mentioned rideshare, and I started thinking about I maybe work in a building where we have many people that don't all work for the same company. There is a piece of paper downstairs that's a rideshare piece of paper. We have five people sign up. And I give people rides. They give me $5 a ride for gas or whatever it is. That's kind of, I think, the start of all of this. But as a personal auto insurance holder, I am giving these people a ride to work, and I'm getting reimbursed for gas or whatever it is. But nobody there works for the same thing, and the communication network really is that piece of paper that people are signing up on. How does insurance coverage happen for people that are doing that on a regular basis? 5 days a week out of the 7 days they drive, they're driving with other people in the car.
Representative Keto, through the chair, that is a little bit esoteric, but I'm going to take my shot at it. And the next speaker, or I can correct me if I'm wrong, but That is not having your vehicle for hire, and that's the key, in a nutshell. I mean, there's different exceptions in your personal property, your personal auto policy. But I think you would be covered because you're not out there for hire, and that's the difference. This is a the TNCs are a commercial enterprise. They're making money on it. And that is a significant difference.
Okay. Thank you. And next up is Bryce Bennett. Welcome, Bryce. State your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time today. My name is Bryce Bennett, and I am the Senior Operations Manager for Uber here in the Northwest. Contrary to what most people think, I'm not from San Francisco. Not all of us are Californians. But out of Seattle, actually. I spent quite a bit of time up here working on the Anchorage process, but today before you, this bill is directly dealing with a narrower scope. This is specifically addressing the relationship and the workers' compensation piece that is currently being evaluated here in Alaska. To provide a little bit of context, what Uber is. We're a platform that connects riders and drivers through a mobile application. We bring a really unprecedented level of accountability to the transportation industry. You have complete accountability as a rider. You know who's coming to pick you up. It's a cashless system. It's all done through credit cards, which removes a lot of danger for drivers. On top of that, there's a continuous feedback loop and rating system after every single trip that is taken. For the drivers, I'll give a little bit of context on the drivers that leverage the platform, the small businesses, the independent contractors that use this system to either make anywhere from or do a couple trips a week to sometimes 30 or 40. It's completely up to them. To become a partner on the system, you apply online, you submit documents, basic documents that you would imagine affiliated with your vehicle registration, your proof of insurance, driver's license. You also go and get a 19-point vehicle inspection at a local certified mechanic. It might be a Midas, Meineke, some of the larger chains out there. And then you go through a stringent and thorough background check that goes back 7 years, looks at motor vehicle record check, goes through a 7-year criminal background check, as well as a national criminal sex offender database registry check. And then we do a social security trace that goes and pulls local, county, and multi-state court records as well. Only after taking all of these steps can someone then have access to the platform. But after pulling the people that do partner on our system and use the system to make money, they said one of the greatest things about it is actually the flexibility, not necessarily the money. They can come on and come and go as they please. Like I said, you could just decide not to sign on to the application at all for a week. Some people do it once a week. Sometimes people only go out on Friday and Saturday nights to help get people home from bar break. These people are anywhere from people that are part-time, engaged in part-time jobs. They might have a full-time, sometimes stay-at-home moms. Really a wide variety of people that can leverage this platform in a lot of different ways. But the main theme there is that they have complete flexibility. They own their own personal vehicles. Like I said, Uber does not own or lease or have any vehicles at all. On average, these drivers are only doing 20 hours per week on the application, or I should say 20 hours per month. Further, in contrast to another transportation option, taxi cab companies, they're dispatched. Many times they're on a set shift. They're leasing that vehicle from a permit owner. In the case here with Uber-affiliated partners, they have the option to receive that request whether they want to or not. What happens is they get a simple beep to their phone, their smartphone application, and it's up to them whether they would like to actually go and pick up that person or not. Further, depending on the city, you would also be required to go and get a business license, just depending. In Seattle, for example, all the partners that use the system have their own business license with the city. No equipment is provided by Uber to the partners. Further, I believe one of the conditions for taxi cab companies here in the state of Alaska to be exempt from this is that it is a rate-based fare. In other words, by mile or minute. In our case, that's how fares are calculated. It is by mile and per minute. And beyond that, partners take 80% of that calculated fare every single time. There's no shifts. There's no hourly rate that they have while they're on the platform. Finally, partners receive a 1099 at the end of each year. There's no tax withholding. We send that in January, of course, of every year for their tax reasons. And then in other cities where we do have other operators like Lyft and Sidecar, where there's more competition, we don't have any exclusivity with partners. They're able to, if they would like, have all three applications on their phone and be affiliated with Sidecar, Lyft, and Uber. That's not uncommon to make the most efficient use of their time. The bottom line here is that this bill in front of you is looking directly and narrowly at the workers' compensation piece. No other state in the United States has classified Uber-affiliated partners as employees. There are other states evaluating this. Arkansas, Florida are two examples. But when it comes down to this, I would like to also address the insurance piece just briefly, because that has come up more so. There are no gaps in insurance coverage. I'd be happy to go through and explain this. I believe you have a chart also available to you that takes you through each level of our insurance policy, starting with period one. Period one is what we call when the application is on, but there's no transaction taking place. No one has been connected to a rider yet. They're most likely potentially sitting in their family room or living room. They could turn it on just to see if it's busy out there. At that point, there's no commercial activity going on. To address the tragic case in San Francisco that was mentioned earlier, in that case, that was during this period one time period, and the personal auto insurance did offer up to the limits of the insurance policy in that case, just to clear that piece up. Moving on to period two, when someone does receive a request and it comes in, like I said, there's a vocal beep, it's very simple. It's actually easier to just tap the screen of your smartphone to accept it than changing the radio station in your car. At that time, that's when our primary $1 million of commercial insurance kicks in. You'll see that in periods two and three there, period two being while the driver is on the way to pick up a rider, and then period three being while the rider is actually in the car. At that time, there's $1 million of primary coverage. We step in, like I said, primary provider. It also extends to uninsured motorist coverage and underinsured motorist coverage, and if the personal policy of the driver has it, collision as well. I'll wrap up here just by saying that I think we do hope to address the more narrow scope and issue that is trying to be clarified in this bill. We are working with the City of Anchorage to work towards a more comprehensive solution that would allow us to again operate in the state of Alaska. As an update, there we paused operations a couple weeks ago after doing 5 months of free rides, tens of thousands of free rides in the Anchorage area, partnering with almost 100 small businesses, and providing, like I said, rides to thousands of people. I sincerely appreciate the time that you've all taken to look into this, and if I can answer any questions, please let me know. Thank you.
I have a question. Did you say that on average they're logged on 20 hours a month only, the drivers are? Was that 20 hours a week?
Madam Chair, I apologize. I misspoke. 5 hours per week or 20 hours per month.
Okay. So are they using those vehicles then? Typically, is there anything to prohibit them from using those vehicles for personal matters then during all those other hours during the month then, right, that typically they're used for other things, I imagine?
Madam Chair, that is correct. We see, like, people can use their personal vehicles as they see fit. They, like I said, they typically use them primarily more so for that than on the system or on the application.
Okay, I was just surprised it was only 5 hours a week. I imagined it to be more. Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, you have real confidence in the coverage, and my question is, if the language really nationwide were so tight airtight that from the moment the app was touched, well, your position is that that's not commerce, that it's commerce when you pick up a rider?
Madam Chair, Representative Josephson, that is when the driver accepts the ride, excuse me, accepts the connection. That's when it comes through and they actually accept the request from the rider to go and pick them up. That is when our commercial insurance begins, at that point, when there's a connection made for a commercial transaction.
Okay.
Follow up, Representative Josephson.
How many instances of litigation have there been where there's something that happens in period one prior to the app connection and a request for a pickup?
Madam Chair, Representative Josephson, during our time here in Alaska, we had no issues during period one that were made aware to us.
Okay. Yep. I mean, I will say, my I'm not an insurance attorney, but each state would have essentially a case if the statute didn't make it clear that where the court would fill the gap and it would decide whether the coverage started where this gentleman indicates or before. And so I don't think it's, are you sure you can say, if I may, you can say dispositively that there's no dispute, but that you're covered from app on, basically receipt of a request to the end?
Madam Chair, Representative Josephson, in the period one time period, which is what we're talking about, app on, essentially, before the a request is received, that's when we have the contingent policy. The issue really is who's primary. In this case, the personal insurance is primary during that time. The state of Illinois actually passed comprehensive state legislation that aligned with that. Multiple other states around the country are working on this piece as well. But during that covered time period, whether it's the personal insurance policy, if they have any issues there, the driver, our contingent policy would then kick in at that point. We've actually provided these insurance policies to multiple cities and states around the country, including the city of Anchorage. They have that policy.
Okay. Representative Keto.
Thank you. The question, I guess, when we're talking about period one, you have contingent. So you did mention in your testimony that you could have multiple apps on. So if there is an incident, how does the insurance coverage get determined when you have three different carriers that are activated during period one?
Madam Chair, Representative Keto, as I said, in Alaska, we've not had that issue during period one. Something I could follow up with our legal team who may have more expertise in it in the state of California, where we've been operating longer and there are more competition, where that may have come up.
Thank you.
I have a question for you, Bryce. You mentioned a state, Illinois, I think, that it's the point of purchase. Is that defining moment as far as when the commercial kicks in? Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. The state of Illinois passed, like I said, state legislation that identified the contingent coverage as well as the primary commercial coverage happening when a ride is requested, which is aligning with the language currently in this bill.
Okay, and as background information, only to be fair, are there states that have passed that the defining moment is at the point the app goes on?
Madam Chair, in the state of California, it's set by the PUC there. It transitioned recently to an app on. In the state of Colorado, it is app on as well.
Okay, so we have two states where it's app on, one where it's point of purchase, and then is this under consideration, you mentioned, in some other states right now?
Madam Chair, there is a wide range of legislation currently out in the going on right now across multiple states. It just depends state by state.
Okay, thank you. Representative Josephson?
Yeah, thank you. It just, through the chair, it just seems to me that at some point this is just, there's nothing magical about, that comes from sort of the heavens about when the clock begins. It's pure policy call. And why shouldn't, if prior to the existence of Uber, companies like State Farm and Farmers didn't cover this sort of activity and said they didn't cover it, why should the burden be shifted to them in that period where the driver is perhaps distracted, they're looking to see if someone's engaged their phone, and they're looking, they're really out in the field and out in the streets because they're interested in a ride. I mean, it's not your position that Uber doesn't treat that as sort of economic activity just because it says so, is it? I mean, am I making sense? The courts would determine whether that was an economic activity, wouldn't they, ultimately, if there was no statute describing it?
Madam Chair, Representative Josephson, in the case of the courts making a judgment, I'm not familiar in any situation where that has happened. Most states, like I said, have addressed it in one shape, way, or form through legislation.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you
very much, Mr. Bennett. And we have off-net. We have Arnand. Okay, I'm going to need glasses for this. Feliciano. Yes, Armand. Yes.
Yes.
State your name for the record and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Sure, Madam Chair, thank you. Armand Feliciano with the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America. Thank you for your time. I don't think I'm going to reiterate State Farm's testimony. I think that testimony was spot on. The real issue here is that you have a TNC service definition that's so narrowly defined that the courts will have to step in and interpret that to mean that if a driver is roaming around without a passenger, gets in an accident, under that definition, he or she is not doing TNC services, and therefore Uber is off the hook. But let me back up for a second and make sure I kind of respond to Uber's testimony, because I think that's probably more appropriate use of my time here. So just straight to the gap issue, as Sheldon said earlier, 22 state regulators have already said that the personal auto insurance does not cover that period, what they call period one. And that's sort of the main debate here, is that when you turn that app on, you are really engaging in a commercial activity. And that's a matter of opinion that we're having a difference with Uber. Uber feels that is still personal use, and we feel that's commercial use. But just to make it clear, that's really sort of the heart of the issue here, in that their insurance contingent to the personal auto insurance. We're saying personal auto insurance doesn't cover that activity, and that's exactly where the gap is. Because what happens is if there's an accident, the driver says, oh, I was doing Uber. The investigation shows that. The personal auto insurance will not cover it, and then they will have to go to Uber, and Uber may have to investigate it and say, well, we disagree. I think it should cover it. So you don't really want an auto insurance coverage based on courts where they have to step in. I mean, we can all agree that Uber as an option for transportation is great. Okay, we all agree on that. But we can also agree you don't want insurance law to be so gray on a matter like this. I heard the response from Uber's representative is it hasn't happened in Alaska. Well, you don't want to wait till it happens in Alaska, right? Uber's home state in California, that's precisely what happened. He had an Uber driver, period one. That was the issue that we had to settle in California. Now, just to be clear, so 36 states are debating this insurance coverage today. My organization is involved in that nationally. We are trying to work it out. Four states, including California, Uber's home state, has already agreed thereupon. Let me just be clear. So I believe that's California, Colorado, the District of Columbia, and I believe West Virginia has agreed that Appon is the beginning of this TNC services. So it is kind of, it's kind of striking for us to hear that for some reason, you know, if Uber's already willing to do it in California, why not extend that same level of protection in Alaska? So for us, we'd be happy to work with Uber on this. We've worked with them in California. We think the California model would work. They supported it in California. Now, Illinois is a minority state. They're the first one to say, well, only when somebody accepts the ride. So I'm just trying to lay out sort of national conversation on this issue. I would say this. There was a question about rate insurance. What's going to happen? What's the proper insurance for the Uber drivers? Well, so what happened in California is Uber had recently agreed to a hybrid policy to make it affordable. So it's not personal. It's not commercial. It's hybrid policy to cover this unique driver that's going around now that's happening. So it's by metro mile. So there is an answer to that. There was also a question about someone providing rides. The distinction there is that, again, if you're just providing rides, getting money for gas, that's really different from making a living out of your car, right? You're not logging on 5 hours a day to make money off of this. Madam Chair, I'll stop there. I know I just wanted to summarize it, but again, I think our position is we're opposed to this, and for us, we'd be happy to work out the insurance issues with Uber as we did in other states. Again, we feel like we've already settled this in other states. You know, why not just extend it to Alaska? Okay. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Armand. I have a quick question, and we are up against the clock, but I'm just wondering if commercial insurance started at the point the app was on, and it was a slow day, and the driver decided they were going to pick up their dry cleaning and then go pick up their fourth grader, but the app is on during that time. If an accident occurred during that time, would the commercial insurance cover it, even though they were doing using their car more as a personal use, even though the app was on?
Right. So I think on that, and that's why you need a hybrid policy. Right. We're not necessarily advocating for commercial insurance. We get the gist of your question is, if you were to flip the script, then what? So the way we've handled that, at least in the other jurisdiction, is just we just made it clear that from the moment it's on, you should have a hybrid policy to at least protect that driver. You know, one of the things that we suggested, actually, that was brought up in other jurisdiction, is that, you know, it's not all that hard to come up with a kill switch, right? If the app has been on for an hour and there's no movement, that driver's not working for you, okay? That driver is somewhere just hanging out. The other thing that I want to point out to you folks, it wasn't really addressed in other jurisdictions, the multiple app issue is a real issue. Some of these drivers, when this thing gets really popular in Anchorage, some of these drivers conceivably will have three phones on, Lyft, Uber, and some other company, right? That hasn't been addressed. But I just want to throw that out there. Someone brought that up as an issue. It's a real legal mess if that were supposed to happen. If something happened and all three apps were on, that could be a real legal mess.
Okay, thank you, Armand. We have one more person to testify. Susan Gonski, are you there?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Committee Chairs. My name is Susan Gorski, G-O-R-S-K-I. I'm the Executive Director of the Chugiak Eagle River Chamber, and I am calling on behalf of both the Chamber and a very, very frustrated community. It's been interesting listening to the testimony as you're wrestling with this myriad of details on the transportation network companies and how they might safely operate in Alaska. And we recognize these are new challenges for all of us, and it's a rapidly changing technology. But I just want to take a second and support Representative Dan Sadler's comments going back to the 10,000-foot view. We need to be able to increase transportation options. I have a file at least 2 inches thick that goes back to the 1990s on trying various scenarios. The taxicab industry, based on how it's regulated in Anchorage, cannot serve this area. It won't serve this area. It doesn't even make sense from a financial standpoint for them to be out in this area. So we are totally lacking in both intra-community transportation and within communities. And so the private sector has brought forth a very innovative concept here. And I hear the insurance issues, and hopefully somebody will find a product and make money off of it and kind of solve the whole thing. But we're 35,000 people without the ability to have support transportation networks in place. These transportation network companies are in over 200 cities. They're in 47 countries. It's a billion-dollar industry. We need it up here. It's going to bring efficiencies to the market. And I do believe from what I have read and seen to date in other cities that They have self-implemented or self-patrolled, if you will, safety measures for both drivers and passengers, rigorous background checks, and those are the issues that the public is concerned about. So we want to have this opportunity and this chance, and I strongly encourage you to continue working through this issue for a positive resolution. And I think it's going to be a win-win for all of us. And that concludes my testimony. I'll take questions if there are any.
Thank you, Susan, and I apologize. I mispronounced your last name. That's what happens when I don't put my glasses on. The R looked like an N. So I want to thank you. You, it's clear you're a fan of TNCs and Sealers in Need, so thank you for that today. I'm going to leave open public testimony. We're going to set this bill aside, and we're going to move on to the final bill during our final stretch here. It's HB 58. I would invite the sponsor up to the table, Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins, if you would state your name for the record and tell us all about HB 58.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jonathan Christ Tompkins. I represent rural Southeast Alaska and the Energy Committee substitute for HB 58 relates to the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Fund and eligibility to the AEERLF. And the intent and utility of the bill is fairly simple. It basically expands the eligibility for the revolving loan fund from just public entities like school districts, municipalities, University of Alaska, to nonprofit entities as well, such as churches, soup kitchens, American Legion halls, chambers of commerce, etc. And the rationale behind the bill is that the Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Fund has been phenomenally underused since its inception a few years ago. In fact, there's been effectively one loan application, and there's yet to be sort of a fully processed and executed loan from the revolving loan fund. So given that the loan fund has the authority to bond up to $250 million, there's a lot of public value and potential inherent in the loan fund, and we want to make sure that it benefits Alaska, Alaskans, and Alaska buildings as much as possible. And by expanding eligibility to institutions that contribute to Alaska communities, such as these nonprofits, we think would fulfill that goal. And we think it's sort of timely and harmonious given the budget climate, and that many of these nonprofit organizations have an operational strategy that often revolves around capital grants, in other words, free money, when it comes to making improvements to their physical plant or buildings. And obviously that era is largely coming to an end because, at least as far as the legislature goes, there is not a lot of grant money to go around. And we feel that this bill creates a viable means for these nonprofit entities to become more self-sufficient and independent as far as maintaining their facilities through low-interest loans, and that's a direction we clearly need to go as far as helping nonprofits become more independent, more self-sufficient when there's less grant money and less free money to go around. So that's sort of a synopsis of the bill, and of course would be eager to take any questions the committee might have.
Members of the committee have a question. Okay. Representative Josephson, I thought I could count on you.
Just as your colleague, Chairman Olson, can. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Christ Tompkins, what do you attribute to this underutilization to?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, it's a great question. When I first became aware of this revolving loan fund 2 years ago, upon first being elected to office, I contacted literally every municipal government and school district in my district, and I have a rural district, so that's a lot of contacts. I think it's probably about 30 different conversations with school administrators or city administrators saying, hey, this program exists, no one's using it, it could be potentially really helpful, especially because a lot of the communities in my district, for instance, have extremely high energy costs, you know, $6 a gallon heating oil, 60 cent a kilowatt hour electricity. But there was little interest because the last 2 years, even though we were in a deficit situation, public entities could reliably turn to the state of Alaska for capital grants. And why would you apply for a low-interest loan when you could get free money from the state? And that's basically the logic that I think has been inherent in a lot of administrators' minds, partly because it's good logic. I mean, why would you not get free money if you could get a low-interest loan? So that was what we encountered. I think we're entering a new era where entities, public or nonprofit alike, are going to have to become more self-sufficient. So I think it's fair to say that there's at least a greater likelihood that more entities, public entities or nonprofit entities, are going to look for low-interest loans because the spigot of free money has been turned off. So we think this is a great vehicle to sort of direct their attention to, now that I think they need more focused on opportunities like this.
Thank you.
And I'll follow up with that one, with being that the free money is not going to be there, we might expect more public entities to step up, as you might mention. So if we have a big rush of public entities and nonprofits lining up, how would that work as far as this? Was there a preference then for the public, or how you want to address that?
Madam Chair, a prescient question indeed. Mm-hmm. On page 5, lines 10 through 13, is language that was added in the Energy Committee, which I think is important language, and it creates sort of a two-tier prioritization or preference. And so, I mean, say there was a gold rush. Every nonprofit in Alaska sort of started running at this at the same time. And so were public entities like school districts and municipalities. And AHFC just had way too many applications on their hands. The language that was inserted in Energy Committee, which I fully endorse and think makes the bill better, creates a prioritization or preference for public entities. So if AHFC either doesn't have enough available capital from in the loan fund, or doesn't have enough administrative capacity to process this barrage of applications they may suddenly receive, HFC is instructed to give preference and to prioritize public applications over non-applications. And if they still have excess administrative capacity or capital in the loan fund, they would then process the nonprofit applications after taking care of all the public entities first.
And would you tell us, were you approached by nonprofits, or was this just an idea you had? How did this come to be, this bill?
There's a little serendipity behind HB 58, you could say. This came about partly because my first 2 years I was sort of schlepping around the district, you know, calling all these administrators saying, hey, you know, just FYI, great program. Because, I mean, I think that's part of a legislator's job, is to communicate opportunity and familiarity you have with state government and opportunities that exist therein with entities in your district. And I thought this might have been sort of a connection-making opportunity. So I was really familiar with the program, and I sort of kept thinking on it because it clearly wasn't working because no one was applying for it, and trying to think, you know, how do you create value out of something that is not presently creating value? And I had a conversation with the nonprofit administrator in Sitka, where I'm from, maybe November or October of last year. And he was, you know, great organization, lauded locally and statewide, has got a great reputation. But like most nonprofits, you know, every $500 means the world to them. And they have a lot of physical assets, lots of buildings. They own like something like 19 buildings in Sitka, many of which are very old and, you know, were built without insulation and single-pane windows. So they deal with energy costs in a big way. I remember him saying, you know, we would love to put insulation in some of these buildings. We would love to put in LED lights or double or triple pane windows. And the return on investment is amazing. Our payback period is like 3 years, which is terrific. But we just don't have enough access to cash to even, like, the maximum energy investments we can make are like a 2-year payback period. So really the problem was access to capital, not that there were amazingly good energy efficiency investments that were to be had. And so as he was telling me that, I immediately connected, like, my gosh, there's a $250 million revolving loan fund for this very purpose that exists in the state that no one is using. It's just gathering dust. And it would sure make a lot of sense to connect A and B. So that was when it happened. And then I say there's serendipity behind this bill because upon doing more research, I proceeded to email the Foraker group, since they're sort of the authority on nonprofit administration, and asked them, like, hey, here's an idea. What do you think? You know, good, bad, awful? And they informed me that they'd actually been doing a pilot project in Fairbanks, which is, of course, the champion of high energy costs in Alaska, well, one of the many, and a pilot project doing this very thing, which is connecting a nonprofit entity in Fairbanks, which I believe deals with folks with developmental disabilities and has a few buildings that they own, with low-interest loans and trying to make that work. And so that's a pilot project that's a partnership between, if I can get this right, the Foraker Group, Rasmussen Foundation, Cold Climate Housing Research Center, and the Denali Commission. And that pilot project is, well, there'll be testimony on the line speaking to it, was, you know, very much in harmony with the thinking behind this bill. And so we started collaborating, drafted some legislation, and this bill is the byproduct of that thinking and those conversations.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I want to, there are people waiting online. It looks like we have three who'd like to testify, and we're up against the hour, so I'm going to open public testimony at this time. And I'm going to ask those, thank you so much for patiently waiting. We're eager to hear from you. If you're able to keep your testimony very brief, 2 to 3 minutes would be helpful. And we'll start first with John Anderson. John, if you're online, you may state your name for the record and your affiliation and begin your... Oh, I'm sorry. John was on for questions only. So I'm going to go to Daniel Powers, if you could state your name and affiliation.
Thank you very much. My name is Daniel Powers, and I'm work at Cold Climate Housing Research Center as a project coordinator for the Fairbanks nonprofit retrofit pilot. And we're working with 14 buildings, about 10 building owners in Fairbanks, to help both tribal organizations and nonprofits get a handle on their energy efficiency through energy and facility planning, energy auditing, scoping, design, and a lot of other components of project development that go into really bringing an energy efficiency project from an idea through the lending process, what we're talking about now, all the way to completion, and finally monitoring and verifying. I believe HB 58 is a really great step in the direction of helping nonprofits, the folks who really provide essential services for some of the most vulnerable populations in Alaska, take advantage and capitalize on their own energy efficiency resource. So to be brief, I think HB 58 is a great idea because it will help reduce the state's responsibility or historical responsibility towards nonprofits in state capital grants. It will change nonprofit and tribal grant-based culture for energy efficiency improvements, and it will enable both groups to reduce their operation costs and do more mission in our communities. So I am a strong supporter. Thank you, and I'll be online for questions.
Thank you very much, Daniel. And next up, we have Victoria Morozova. If you'd state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed.
Hello. Thank you so much, Madam Chair and committee members, for hearing my testimony. I am Victoria Morozova, and I live in Anchorage. I'm an 11th grader at Stellar Secondary School, and I'm the chair for Alaska Youth for Environmental Action of the Anchorage chapter. I'm here representing Alaska Youth for Environmental Action, and I am here to testify for the support of HB 58. Today, I would like for you to consider the importance of energy efficiency to not only lowering our carbon footprint, but also decreasing the amount of money going to waste. Furthermore, I would like to emphasize the success of the Revolving Loan Fund and the benefits it would bring to Native tribes and nonprofits if it is made available to them. For example, the faculty at my school, Stellar Secondary, said that we would be able to use the loan to invest in more efficient lighting, LED lights, and change our windows to be more energy efficient by making them smaller and install a better heating system. These kinds of changes would allow the ASD to save money and use it to provide a better education to students. And as a student of the Anchorage School District, I feel that that's very important to be receiving the most quality education that I can. Likewise, other buildings can make better use of our state's money with the help of this bill. Please pass HB 8 to ensure a better use of our money and our energy. Thank you.
Thank you, Victoria. And next up we have Carmela Flynn. Carmela, if you could state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed.
My name is Carmela Flynn, and I represent Alaska Youth for Environmental Action. I am a sophomore at Hutchison High School in Fairbanks, and I'm here in favor of House Bill 58. And I'm testifying in support of HB 58 because I believe it would render beneficial to many of the buildings I go to regularly. And these would include my church, the library, and even the hospital I go to. Another example, as you heard, is school. And I've noticed our archaic means of energy just fishing, and they're obviously hurting the environment. So having the loans to upgrade would be an investment to enhance our equipment. And, you know, just through these loans, it raises awareness of more efficient ways to save energy, reduce fuel emissions, and overall just aiding climate change. So, yeah, thank you for allowing me to testify today, and I urge you to pass this bill.
And thank you, Ms. Flynn, for being on, and all of you for hanging in there. And with that, I'm going to close. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony, and I would entertain a motion to move the CS. We realized we needed to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm in CS HB 123 version /W.
All right. Is there any committee discussion? I would entertain a motion to move HB 58 from committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move CS HB 58 29 LS 0254 /F from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you. And hearing no objection, HB 58 moves from committee. And we will stick around after we adjourn to sign the packet, please. And if there's no further business to come before the committee, the meeting is adjourned at, 4:59 p.m. Have a good weekend, everyone.